Blog Talk Radio.
So nice to have you join us again here at Masonic Effects. It's wonderful. I'm in mid-summer. So listeners from New Zealand, brr. I hesitate even to make light of weather anymore because some serious things are happening around our environment, and it's going to get much more challenging for us. How to move on? This isn't the point of the program, but it is the reality of a listener. So I hope that this is a welcome to you, whether you're sitting in a flood zone or tornado zone or experiencing this excruciating heat and danger. Be safe, my goodness. We have an interesting program today, and I think it fits in so many ways. It's not exactly a challenge to find that Masonic values do apply in the general world around us. It's like saying, would the world be any better if we taught ethics in the school system? We do in a way, but not so much to early impressionable minds. And that seems to be a battlefield right now. Who's going to be in charge of those impressionable minds, and what content are they going to be absorbing? It's interesting to see. If you have a generation under your belt, you'll probably be able to sit and look at what's happening and make a value judgment. We've always been a bit of a contentious crowd. Now we're seeing the exercise of the expression of relationships changing because people have access to new tools. New responsibilities and new powers, in a way, power of the word and the power of the agora, of the crowd. And like anything, you can tell, these are when people have not had power and they're given power, they exercise it. And it's not much different in a way than riding a bike. The first time you got on a bike, you didn't know how to ride it. We didn't know how to ride it. We have to learn that balance. And so is it a mistake when we fall off? I guess you could say that. That would be a bit bleak to say that every time somebody learning to ride a bike falls, that it's a mistake. It's part of the learning process. You know, the bicycle wobbles, and we learn that by pedaling and sitting upright, you know, we gain a little control until we can ride with no hands, you know, unusual, or with our moms yelling at us and worried about, you know, the dental work that's going to disappear on the handlebars, you know, that, all of that. But we have people are exercising a new responsibility, and it's rough. It's not pretty to watch. It never is. People make mistakes. They go overboard. They have to. It's part of that pendulum. No, this is what I want, that balance point. But how many of us would think that it's the pendulum is just hanging still in air? It swings, yeah? It swings both ways. And when it hits extremes, history reminds us why we try to avoid that, why we attempt to avoid it with so much, because it's so, so costly and it leaves a legacy of damage. Mm. And do we recover eventually? Yeah, we do. A couple of hundred years and we can recover from most things. But it does have an effect, a lasting effect. My goodness, yes. But that's just history. And when we're walking down the street, we don't think, oh, my goodness, here I wake up and I'm going to be living history today. And history's hindsight, isn't it? What you and I do day by day, living in the moment, which is putting that baggage behind us and having a positive and fresh outlook on life that doesn't make it sound ridiculous. So it's a conversation that we may hesitate to hold unless we trust somebody enough, and they have that inclination as well. And then, by golly, you have something good going on, very interesting, or you've got a shared responsibility. That's the foundation of decent friendship, you think. Let's give people their due. Some people are doing remarkable things just to keep body and soul together. They've for anybody in a better situation to be criticizing is, I think, inhumane. A simplified value judgment to the degradation of other people, I think, is appalling. And no amount, no numbers make that right. And if it's 1,000 people doing it, it certainly doesn't make it right at all. It's appalling. But we're learning that we're losing our tolerance for so long. We've had our tolerance for poverty, and it's stratified things, and we've been able to rationalize that. Like we have some intelligence, and we've created these big systems. You know, the systems have produced a lot, and to get our minds around that, it would take a long conversation, and I'd love to do that. But that's the kind of conversation that I think needs to be done with the spirit of the college. You remember your college days when you sat around the pub and you had read the chapters and you were assimilating, you were besting your mates, and they were calling out your arguments, and it was just a great fun. And then it was your route. You know that camaraderie that develops after that, and to be repeated over and over. So not a one-off, but for some that was an important part, and for most of us an important part of the development of the learning the culture. There's a certain responsibility that comes with more education or with time. You can learn visually, as many people do, but not everybody is a visual learner. Some people are audible learners, And so they learn in a different way. Once upon a time, back in the 50s, all those children were, you know, you remember when we were being slaughtered by somebody that, you know, people that were just, it was pure conjecture, a lot of speculation. This is what we know. They were, back in those days, they were crowing about knowing and understanding and, you know, intelligence and how to engineer intelligence. They couldn't, and it was as you would expect, a bloody failure. But to look at our values, you know, the tolerance of poverty, and our capacity to, you know, to justify it, there's no limit to that. There's no limit to our capacity to justify the suffering of other people. But to, oh my goodness, take any responsibility for changing that, it's a different conversation. That, and in my mind, if I ever said that I thought the world was capable of that, that would be such a high level of abstraction. It would have very, very little meaning. But it needs to be said. It's true. At the end of the day, we're seeing authoritarianism is growing again. It's not the first time. It's not the second time. But it is part of the landscape, and we've known about this for a long time. It depends who you read, you know, what work you're reading. So to be candid, yes, we have known about this, and we've identified a lot of the processes that accelerate it, like the politics that incites aggression and violence, you know, and takes no responsibility for outcomes. That's been with us for a long, long time. This is nothing new. It's been with humanity for ages. So to see it now, though, the interesting thing right now is that we don't have to wait a month for the news to reach us from over there. We don't have to, and you remember that sometimes events would happen, whole wars and battles would start and end, and there would be people within those kingdoms that had no idea because they were, because of communication and isolation, you know. So interesting, it's a paradox. We've overcome that in distance and time. And now we've just had, you know, more wireless things installed in our houses. It's kind of fascinating. But not everybody can afford this. And ought they? As a moral creature, yeah, do I? Ought they to eat? We're sending children to school. They're hungry. And in the summer, they don't have the lunch programs. And we're pretty good at ignoring that as the families line up at the food kitchens, and the lineup gets longer and longer. We can pretty much ignore that. But it's hard to justify that something could have been done about that suffering. You know, we'll get there. It takes a while, and it's painful because we can watch it in real time now. And it's hard. So when you get into that, you know, 100 years ago, my dear grandfather didn't experience something like compassion fatigue, but he wasn't bombarded constantly by advertisers trying to gain his attention for some good deed or some benefit. He wasn't. He lived far more isolated, and that isolation, it meant that it wasn't like he was, you know, walking around sniffing the daisies every day. You know, he was busy and his mind was full of running his operations. Full enough, my goodness, yes. And planning and discussing, being a participating member of the community. These were the days when if something happened to your neighbor, everybody in the neighborhood picked up their tools and went over to rebuild. You know, now we say, oh, that's that interesting religious sect that does it. But back in the day, that was considered community. And it still is. In some areas, that still exists. Don't think it's only rural or you don't know cities. Some city areas, years ago when I worked in Detroit, I discovered that there were whole communities inside those the inner city that were doing really beautiful things for and with each other. It was quite remarkable to see in action. Today, our progress is that we have this compression of information, and it feels it after a while. You know, we're the only ones in that position. We're the first that have lived through this many years and experienced that increase in demand for our attention, and now just to treat us. You know, the cherry on the cake is AI, isn't it? Artificial intelligence is just going to, now that we've exhausted your attention, and now that you experience compassion fatigue, it's just too much. That we do have that limit. You know, we can be compassionate animals, but there is a limit. How many? Because a long time ago, that kind of effort just became background noise. It's just a din. And what to do is to take charge of it, to take charge and find the solace and find the focus your mind and calm yourself and realize that. That there may be a team of six psychologists at any time that have been working months on a project to take your attention. In other words, they know how to better use your time than you do. And how can we push back on that? We can. But don't be led to believe that there's nothing that we're powerless, because nope, we certainly aren't. We just revolve. We pivot. We turn. We can control. Once we find that it's just background noise, we can still control it. And we see kids doing that. You know, we might be uncomfortable or a bit unusual, but everybody, the kids are generally, have a set of headphones and a cell phone. They stay connected. And while old boys sit back and point to them and say how isolated they are, they don't know. They're guessing. Compared to the way they lived, the old guys lived, it doesn't look right. It doesn't look familiar. But our populations are growing, and will it have lasting effects? Yeah, it will. So will we. It's kind of interesting. However many years it took you to find the pleasure in amazement. That's you riding your Masonic bike, finding the balance for yourself. And once you do, then, you know, you're off, you're having a great time, and you know that, you respect that balance, but nobody can do that for you. So how long does it take when you know that you are absorbing that feeling of understanding, and it's pushing away conflicted and negative emotion. But doing it, we still see, as we develop, you know, become more aware in small ways or big ways, more aware, it doesn't change the world around us. The world around remains consistent. We become an influence, and that influence, we may think of ourselves that way, but if you were to tell me or explain to me the extent of your influence, I think we'd have to really be guessing, because we don't know. Except some of some people have studied it, and it's been very interesting. The effect of a smile. If you walk around with a smile for no reason, just do it. Walk up to people with a smile. That smile is infectious. It makes people feel good. And it disarms people. And yes, we can be, there's always room for cynicism, but there is this problem with cynicism is it doesn't do well with reality. The reality is people are very kind and generous, and to start, they may be a bit like you and I. They may have heard and been taught some prejudice or some bias about other people, but the real experience is quite different. People are very, very likable and have a sense of humor, and if we give ourselves an opportunity to connect, and what does it take? A little more than politeness, treating people with a dignity. That's not exactly a hardship. That's not exactly a hardship. But to do that, we need to be able to, I think, now you deserve this. If you're doing that, I think you deserve this. I think for some men join the, I think your masonry is about finding, being a mason is about finding an expression, being able to express these values, not owning them or thinking about them. It's how we express them. So can you, can you and I express a high value without being able to articulate? I think that makes sense to me. And are other people more hesitant and need it to follow the logic before they can act? Yeah, that's no doubt about that. And are we are we always the same energy level, the same focus? No. Some days, don't you ever drag yourself around some days? And aren't you ever distracted by some alarm or some demand that's happened? Well, yeah, that's normal, isn't it? And of course, it's sounding like a relatively well-off middle class isn't as easy today as it once was. Not at least it's not for me or for many. The struggle goes on, but so does masonry, and knowing that some men, and who could blame them, some men join masonry for the experience, and some men join masonry for answers. I hope you get a kick out of the show today. I really do. The commentary is really pretty good. Validation. It's interesting. The poetry of Emily Dickinson. We really have to talk about the status of women. And some music that is just sizzling. Check this. Yeah, Art Blakey. Nice man. Lovely. A saint. Yep. That's what they were rocking to in 1958. Art Blakey helped start a lot of the career, jazz musicians' careers. Very generous man. Incredibly popular in Japan during that period. Well, of course. Validation. Validation, my goodness. Truth. Everything in the universe is in motion. It is. So it might seem a bit overstuffed to use the idea to introduce the effects of temporary experiences in a temporary life. I need to make this point to make sense of undercurrent of Urgency. Experience life optimally, we are told. Don't let a minute slip by. In fact, I've never felt I had control over time. Trying to think in terms of the immediacy of thought was trying enough. Like, what's the next thing that's important to do? What's the next duty? Now I'm expected to extract optimal meaning? Are you serious? It makes perfect sense for a man to appreciate the contributions, big or small, including his own, that are necessary for the overall function of society. Yeah, the bigger society, the smaller Masonic society. Though we may not have received mentoring in our youth, Masonry picks up that unfinished process. For some, it can be an introduction. For others, like reading a book for the second or third time. Re-examination gives us new insights, more meaning. Our curiosity and enthusiasm marks us as students. When we become curious and ask why, we identify with philosophy, the field that deals in absolute truths, seeking that influence. Masonry introduces a world of symbolic communication, secrets revealed poetically when a man is ready to receive them. But experience then teaches us they are archetypes. Through the arts and sciences, we are introduced to a simple fact. The world has symbolic meaning. If we are aware and attentive. No one need know what you think, that you think like a poet. No one need know that. It is your inner experience when walking through a field to see those daffodils happily dancing. It's your inner experience. What change that occurs is first and privately known only to you, but publicly exhibited. Yeah. We are not the same men at 80 that we were at 30. The way we react to life has an effect on the way we understand oneself and those around us. One more lonely man is hardly noticed. We are sensate, intelligent creatures. We need ideas and activities that challenge our thinking to stop our minds from turning into mush. If it isn't a challenge, why bother doing it? Lovely. Lovely. I kind of like that. Here. Roy Hargrove. Imagine take an instrument and walk up on a stage and have that effect on people. Incredible. All musicians and performers. It's what you give, all the nervousness and all the work and hours. Well, speaking of which, you're ready for a bit of a surprise. This is a treat for me. I've been thinking about the conditions around me. There's a hell of a lot of misogyny in our system still, and it shows up in our management of certain types of illness. Oh my goodness, yes. And particularly, we have places called women's shelters in this country, where we don't fund it. We don't want to encourage people, women and children to go there. But it's, even in a modest way, it can be a lifesaver, because our system doesn't really help to save the lives of women from the violence of some of these unfortunate men. I was thinking of the condition of women in the 19th century, because that's the period that Emily Dickinson was writing in. And in some areas in the world, it's still like this. And I'm picking this from Cove Studio. So if you're looking for some materials, very, very, I think, charming. In the 19th century, women were expected to uphold a housewife standard. Women were expected to do the cooking, cleaning, and taking care of the children. Their role was way different from men in the 19th century. Women were not allowed to be outspoken, and they were not given the same opportunities as men. That says a fair amount about us. Women were expected to remain subservient to their fathers and husbands. Their occupational choices were also extremely limited. Middle and upper class women generally remained home, caring for their children and running the household. Now, you just fast forward, and it's just because of my academic and professional background. The women today are doing all of that, plus working outside the home. The distribution is still, we look to the model here where I am. We look to Scandinavia for the model where the fathers are very much involved in the development of their children. And look at the results. Arguably, we could say that they're getting a different result and some that are very attractive. So women were considered physically weaker yet morally superior to men, which meant that they were best suited to the domestic sphere. Hmm. We're finding that, you know, that myth. If you're looking for the source of that, you don't have to go too far with these ideas. It's like the source of, you know, this furor over gender identity. You have to look. Historically, was it always there? Well, no. So if you're looking for how it's been incited, you don't have to look really too far. But that's not what is exciting about this woman. Emily Dickinson is considered, you know, she has a reputation of being a bit of a recluse. Her work her poetry wasn't popular. After she died, her sister helped, you know, pulled it all together. But this is and I'll just go through this. This was from the Manchester Guardian. And if any of you are fans of the Guardian, have at it. I think this is from February 13th, 2010. It's A Bomb in Her Bosom, Emily Dickinson's Secret Life. Beneath the still surface of the poet's life lie a fiercely passionate nature and a closely guarded secret, argues the latest biographer, Lindell Gordon. Dickinson was a great poet whose life has remained a mystery. The time has come to dispel the myth of a quaint and helpless creature disappointed in love who gave up on life. I think she was unafraid of her own passions and talent, that her brother's sexual betrayal and subsequent family feud had a profound effect on the Dickinson legend that has come down to us. And perhaps most significantly, I believe that Emily had an illness, a secret that explains much. This is very brief. It was Emily herself who helped to devise the blueprint of her legend, starting at the age of 23 when she declined an invitation from a friend. And this is a quote that I read many, many years ago in school in the classroom. "I'm so old-fashioned, darling, that all your friends would stare." Yeah, so she stayed home. In place of the tart young woman she was, she adopted this retiring posture. Born in 1830, headed into the leading family of Amherst, Massachusetts, a college town, she never left what she always called my father's house. Townsfolk spoke of her as the myth. On the face of it, the life of this New England poet seems uneventful and largely invisible, but there's a forceful, even overwhelming character belied by her still surface. She's called it a still volcano life. And that volcano rumbles beneath the domestic surface of her poetry in 1,000 letters. Stillness was not a retreat from life, as legend would have it, but her form of control. Far from the helplessness she played up at times, she was uncompromising. Until the explosion in her family, she lived on her own terms. Her widely spaced eyes were too keen for the passivity admired in women of her time. It's the sensitive face of a woman who, as her brother put it, saw things directly and just as they were. At 17, as a student at Mount Holyoke in 1848, the same year that the women's movement took a stand at Seneca Falls, she refused to bend to the founder of her college, the formidable Mary Lyon. At this time, Massachusetts was the scene of a religious revival opposed to the inroads of science. Emily, who had chosen mostly science courses, makes her allegiance clear. When Miss Lyon pressed her students to be saved, nearly all succumbed. Emily did not. On the 16th of May, she owned, "I have neglected the one thing needful when all were obtaining it. It seemed that other girls desired only to be good. How I wish I could say that with sincerity, but I fear I never can." When Miss Lyon consigned her to the lowest of three categories, get this, the saved, the hopeful, and a remnant of about 30 no-hopers, she's still, I want to have words with Miss Lyon. She don't, yeah. Imagine. During a creative outburst in the early 1860s, she invited a Boston man of letters to be her mentor, but could not take his advice to regularize her verse. Helpful Mr. Higginson, a supporter of women who thought he was corresponding with an apologetic, self-effacing spinster, was puzzled to find himself drained of nerve power, as he called it, after his first visit to her in 1870. He was unable to describe the creature he found beyond a few surface facts. She had smooth bands of red hair and no good features. She had been deferential and exquisitely clean in her white piqué dress and her blue crocheted shawl. And after an initial hesitation, she proved surprisingly articulate. She had said a lot of strange things from which Higginson deduced a quote, abnormal life. There was an increasing divide between people she wished to know and those she didn't. Her clarity could not endure social talk instead of truth. Piety instead of the soul's superior instance. Her directness would have been disconcerting if she had not simulate conventionality, and this was stinging work. But a more threatening challenge, deeper below the surface, fired the volcanoes and earthquakes in her poems, an event, as she put it, that struck my ticking through. Something in her life has so far remained sealed. The poems tease the reader about it and her almost overwhelming temptation to tell. I want to open up the possibility of an unsentimental answer. If true, it would explain the conditions of her life. During the poetic spurt of her 30s, she transformed sickness into a story of promise. My loss by sickness. Was it lost? Or the ethereal gain? One gains and earns by measuring the grave, then measuring the sun. There. What was it? You see, in the poem that we're going to read, it's a short poem on a columnar self. And this is at three stanzas. It's not much. But what she's writing about is the phrase columnar self refers to the self that has shaped itself up like a column. And such a self has many of the column's desirable traits. The poet begins by stating that such a columnar self would be sufficiently dependable, even under difficult or extreme circumstance. A person with such a self would have the strength and reliability to deal with such situations. The poet finds relief in the certainty of the fact that such a person's convictions cannot be pried open by a lever or divided by a wedge. The poet calls this conviction the granitic base of the column. Just like the column's granite base, the conviction of the columnar self has the strength and stability to not be easily dislodged. Too often, men forego their beliefs and convictions just to side with the majority, even when they know that they themselves are in the right. The poet says that the column, like self, will not compromise on its convictions even when it finds itself alone. I'm pretty sure, as you're listening to this, that some of you or many of you are identifying with this column like self in that capacity. It's a rallying cry for individualism. It states that the strength of the column like self must not be underestimated, and a person who's willing to go against the tide for just cause would be on his or her path to achieving divinity. Light conversation, you would say. On a columnar self, how ample to rely in tumult or extremity, how good the certainty. That lever cannot pry and wedge cannot divide. Conviction, that granitic base, though none be on our side. Suffice us for a crowd, ourself and rectitude, and that assembly not far off from furthest spirit, God. It's like mathematics being, you know, formula being written. Such incredible music, the way it comes together. My goodness. I know you're begging for this, ladies and gentlemen. I know, the gentlemen, brethren, sorry. I know you've been looking forward to this. This is a little bit of back, I find. It's about, I want to talk to you a bit about elections, you know, large elections. And we're going to go back just and take a look through the window of 18th century that we're talking about here. And we're talking about that lodge that gave us so much the detail in and the Dutch Grand Lodge, the Le Bien Ami, the good friends. But the majority, remember, the majority of this lodge were not from the aristocracy. And nevertheless, they assume honor in their right. And much of the civility of a lodge is taken up telling members and visitors how honorable, enlightened, and worthy they are. And the lodge's furniture and silver decorations, its throne for the master, its brother servants, the orchestra that played on special occasions, all were intended to create an aura of splendor and opulence. For these rich merchants, doctors, lawyers, and a few men of baronial title, the Enlightenment only reinforced this sense of specialness, otherness. Thus, much of the lodge activities of the 1750s, when it was not fighting with the Grand Lodge, concerned putting these symbols in place. By the 1760s, these classically educated men increasingly made an analogy between Masonic elections and the solemnities enacted by the ancient Romans during elections and when inaugurations of their magistrates. No other business was more solemn in the life of the lodge. Orators regularly spoke about the original laws and foundations of masonry, or on the true and moral duties of an upright mason, but on the occasion of an election, special orations were given before the voting. Elections proceeded after the master had stepped down from his throne and placed his mallet on the constitution book of the lodge. He would then leave the room purposely, even if reassured that his departure was not necessary, so as not to unduly influence the freedom of the voting. When a master resigned his office, he separated himself from its symbols, taking off his special attire and handing over the staff. Newly elected officers were in turn instructed about the importance of their duties, and then they paraded together with their swords drawn to the throne of lights, where the venerable master had them take the customary oaths. On the occasions of the elections, brothers were exhorted to identify themselves with the virtues associated with the Romans, or to ponder the causes of the decline or ancient Rome. Their actions in this private form self-consciously imitated the ancient civic rights of the Roman Republic. Yet they were also intensely personal. Always the master exhorted his brothers above the love and intense devotion, the brotherly love that they should have for the lodge. Similarly, the Roman dedication to civic duty was depicted as personal and manly, analogous to the rituals performed by fathers when their sons reached their maturity. Masonic duty is similar to both civic and domestic duty, yet it should also come before public duties. Let me say that again. Masonic duty is similar to both civic and domestic duty, yet it should also come before public duties. Fraternity is a living creed that bridges this public and the private. Good? Interesting? One of those, I didn't know that. Let's work hard so we don't drop too much. Well, we seem to have almost kept to a tight schedule, which is fine. Thank you for sitting in wherever you may be around the face of the globe. I hope that you, I hope the show is informative and interesting. We all are about to walk away and think about how we express Masonry, how we operationalize all these our history and the philosophical framework. Yeah, all of that, what that all tends to mean, I think, is an understanding about ourselves right now. Now, we each have our own common history, but Masonry gives us a common Masonic history. So yes, we are alike because we each have our common history. Yes, we are all alike because we inherit or adapt to a Masonic history. But the Masonic work is delightfully focused. It's more like, to me, it's less, you know, muscle and brawn and more zen. I'm one of those that I want both. I want the experience and I want the answers. You know, and it's helped me, understanding that, it's helped me to make sense of some lodges that function very, very happy, but they don't have a direct learning focus. And I say that because when I write articles, they're quick to absorb them, and they keep coming back. And you can imagine, if you've been a listener of Masonic Effects, you know the tone, you know the content and the way that I speak about them. What we're doing is engaging a particular way of looking and thinking about Masonry and ourselves. And these fellows keep coming back to it. So for years. Well, now that tells me something. It tells me I have an audience. Thank you very much. But it also tells me that there's resonance and that they could, for whatever reason, be on the same wavelength as the audience for Masonic Effects. It's a different way of learning, where I'm not, the work isn't acknowledged. It's not like the class, you know, I'm in a theater where there's 200 eager first year students. I don't see that, but everybody's paying their dues. And I don't know, as I shift my thinking, we're paying our dues morally. You going through life with an unexamined life. I do subscribe to that notion but I understand how there are circumstances where it's almost impossible for man to examine his life. Almost impossible. You starve his babies, and you starve his wife and his parents, and watch the effect on him. You put them under threat of a flood or a forest fire, and watch what happens to them. That's what's going around. The nobility of mankind is there. It's all around us. It's all around us. Remember, it's not sensational. It's not, it's not naughty or dirty. You know, it's not going to sell a newspaper by putting somebody's daughter in a provocative clothing on the front page. I can't do that anymore. Can't, and for a long, long time. Once I learned that my eyes, you know, that hurts. That's offensive to people. Why would you do that? And then, rightfully so, I hear a lot of boys saying, "Well, what about me? Well, what about me?" Is we have a different challenge. We may be taking a broom and sweeping the street or washing the sidewalk. Do you remember the merchants who open up early in the morning and take a hose and wash their sidewalk? We are claiming that we're able to and wanting to influence. And we're claiming that we want to do it according to some very, very interesting standards. Who in the world would want to be an influence that is anonymous, to be out of your mind? But when you design, you look at the design of our thinking around charity. I find that so exquisite. So exquisite to be able to help somebody without drawing attention to yourself. That is a rare group of men. And I strive to be, and you that are of that inclination, we're very hard to honor you and to earn my place in that group. Mm-hmm. So don't think those efforts that haven't been acknowledged in your lodge aren't important. Here, good work. And doesn't it feel awkward when you feel that, you know, even a common gesture would be to acknowledge, and it's not there? Now you're doing things because they're the right thing to do, not because of the praise. And it also tells you far more about these other people that are a bit, you know, parsimonious with their thinking. I don't say narcissistic, but parsimonious. Or they could have their own political anxiety. You know, it happens. No, I'm talking about connecting your thoughts, your deeds with the Masonic value. That's why I encourage everybody, read. Or if you're not reading, tune in Masonic Effects. You know, it's a different way of picking up information. And there's no shortage. In this conversation, we're only a glass of, what would we have? How about a Pinot Grigio away from a next conversation? Let's sit down and talk. And I don't necessarily have to write it as a headline or attribute it. It's like, let me think about it. And you listening and having these conversations with you gives me that opportunity to walk away and think about it. I'm forever impressed by the work and the advancement of masonry that I see going on around. But I am not going to say that everybody, that masonry is a generic effort. No, we're not a machine. We're not machines. This is organic. And the work, we know. The talent, we know. The people, the struggle, everybody, here's the secret here. Everybody has their own struggle, their own version of it. So get over that. Privilege? Really? Really? You really want to open up? You want to go down that rabbit hole? We can't do it today. We'll talk about that again. Good. I enjoy producing this show for you. And I look forward to another 10 years of this carrying on with you. We'll get back to Rude Brill. He's playing Clifford Brown here with the Metropole Orchestra Strings. Tight little group, eh? For Dutch guys. Really blown it away. Thank you for tuning in. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. And please, please, include yourself. Include yourself. Yeah, you're worth it. Bye. Yeah.